Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, everyone. I'm Molly Wood. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where even on a Monday, we do what we can to make today make sense.
I'm Kai Risdahl. Welcome back, as it were. Those of you who are new, well, number one, where you've been. Number two, welcome. Here's what we do Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. We do 15 minutes of a little bit of news and a little bit of things that make a smile, although I do not have one today, a smile thing. And then on Tuesdays, we do a deep dive. And I'm going to get to that actually in one of my news items. But that's the way it goes. That's the way it goes.
Yes.
So there we go.
Totally. All right. We're going to start with the news,
both
as Kai promised.
We have two items in our news. We have two items in our
news. Mine are the same. Yours look same-ish, maybe?
Sure. No, they're not. Well, kind of.
Okay. Yeah. Kinda. Mine are definitely related, I think. It would be fair to say that they're related. Over the weekend, the Times had a good story by Nicole Pearl Roth, my old coworker at the New York Times, about basically the hubris that has been at the center of America's cyber warfare policy. Basically, we were, you know, as of like 2007, when the United States created Stuxnet and essentially like set back Iran's nuclear ambitions, you know, a couple of decades. Ever since then, the United States has been like, we are awesome. And has USA.
American exceptionalism.
USA.
Yay.
American exceptionalism. Exactly. Cyber hacking edition. Woo woo.
Yeah.
And has really, really dramatically expanded intrusions and, you know, surveillance even on its own citizens, that we have, that the NSA, upon discovering vulnerabilities and things like routers or internet connected devices, has like not let anybody know because it's super useful for them, that kind of thing. And that now we have entered a point where we essentially started an arms race around cyber warfare. The NSA itself was hacked and a bunch of its tools were stolen, and plenty of countries have been using those to good effect. And now we're very vulnerable, partly because of this hubris. And the SolarWinds hack is an example of that. And I bring that up because it was a good story. I think, you know, the SolarWinds has been like the thing lurking under the surface that we're still waiting for some of the fallout. But then on Monday, today, in Florida, a sheriff there gave a press conference to talk about an unlawful intrusion into the city of Oldsmar's water treatment plant, in which someone remotely accessed the water treatment system and changed. It was detected before it was deployed, but changed the sodium hydroxide level in the water from 100 parts per million to 11,100 parts per million. So I learned from this press conference that sodium hydroxide is lye.
Yes.
And it would be really bad.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Wow. So, and it's not the first time that there's been an attack scenario like this. And Nicole Pearl Roth, I found it on her Twitter account because she was tweeting about how, like, she always makes sure to include water treatment facilities in the examples of, you know, critical infrastructure that could be hacked to horrible effect. Because it's a scenario that really worries her, and it actually occurred today in Florida. Don't know if it's related to SolarWinds. Could literally just be, you know, the fact that all of our systems are online and nobody's that careful with them. But
which is arrogance.
I know
right?
that we're
being not careful with them is arrogance and hubris. That's exactly right. Wow.
Yeah. And you saw that with SolarWinds itself, that there was a bunch of arrogance and hubris and simple passwords, and, you know, it's It's the last line of this article. But and I don't mean to introduce like another disaster scenario when we all already have so many on our plates.
No, go ahead, please, because you were right with the last one. I mean, let's remember a year ago, probably this week, you called the freaking pandemic. Well, it was a year ago, a couple of weeks ago. But come on, man.
Yeah. I mean, it's there's a huge ticking time bomb out there potentially. With this one hack, right? This Russian hack, the SolarWinds attack, which was the shorthand because it seems like other supply chain software makers were involved in this hack. But like, we don't know what the outcome is going to be. We only know that there are vulnerabilities writ large that have also been neglected over the last four years, if not longer. I mean, the guy who was in charge of, you know, the government agency that secures critical infrastructure like this got so consumed fighting the disinformation coming out of the White House while he was working for that White House and getting himself fired, that one imagines the eye was not 100% on that. Like, it's just...
Yeah, this is Chris Krebs, who was at the...
This is Chris Krebs that I'm talking about at,
right? Yeah.
At CISA.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm just throwing that flag up because I know you don't. I know you feel like you don't have that much to worry about right now. So I'm gonna drop that one in there. Water treatment plants. Uh oh. I am the worst.
All right, thanks for coming to my TED Talk, everybody.
Good read though.
All right, mine are of the follow up variety. Neither of which, well, one of which is moderately interesting, and the other one of which is depressing. So you had on Friday that amazing piece from The New York Times, the primal scream, moms trying to keep up and being forced out of the workforce, and that thing that we've been talking about, thanks to you for a very long time on this podcast. From the National Women's Law Center, this item about the labor force in the United States after that January unemployment report. And let's remember, we talked about this, something like 80% of all the jobs lost in this economy in the month of January were women, right? Mm-hmm. They accounted for 80% of the job loss. The other thing that the National Women's Law Center pointed out in a release is that the labor force participation rate of women, that is to say the percentage of women in the labor force, that's the simple way to put it, is the lowest it's been right now since 1988. We are literally going backward in time. We're going back to the years of Ronald Reagan and women in this economy participating in the labor force. And that, I mean, you said it the other day. I've said it before. We'll say it again. This is going to have profound effects on this economy for a generation.
Mm-hmm.
Probably longer.
Yep.
Right? Think about that.
That's outrageous.
1988 was like 35 years ago. That's where we are in women in the workforce. And when you think the real tragedy, other than that absolute number, is that when you think of how much progress had been made, right? Shortly before the pandemic, women were the greater part of the American workforce. Not anymore. Because of all the social factors that we've been talking about, the lack of aid, the way this gets swept under the rug, all of those things. Mm-hmm. So that's number one. Number two, on a follow-up item, and we talked about this a little bit. We've talked about budget reconciliation and how that's how the Democrats are most likely going to get President Biden's economic relief plan through the Senate is by budget reconciliation, which is a legislative device that lets them use only 51 votes instead of the filibuster accommodating 60 votes. Once again, gratuitous plug here for Adam Gentleson's new book about the filibuster. It's called Kill Switch. I really enjoyed it. And I had said, look, I'm not sure that they're going to be able to get a minimum wage increase through on reconciliation, because it doesn't directly affect revenue or spending on behalf of the federal government. And I thought at that point that I was right. And we should say here parenthetically that Joe Biden came out this weekend and said, look, it's probably not going to make it through reconciliation for a whole bunch of other reasons. But turns out, says the Congressional Budget Office, that I might have been wrong, and here's why. So budget reconciliation means you have to have impact on revenue or spending if you want to use this legislative device to pass with a simple majority. And I had said, minimum wage, come on, how can that affect budget and revenue? Well, it turns out the Congressional Budget Office says, in point of fact, if you raise the minimum wage, according to this proposed increase to $15 an hour, the budget deficit would increase $15 billion. And that's a very big deal. And it would have other fiscal impacts that lots of progressive economists are jumping on that mm-hmm. would conceivably make it possible to do it under budget reconciliation. So I would just like to say at this moment, I stand corrected. There may be actual real fiscal effect to raising the minimum wage in a piece of legislation, and that might actually make it qualify for reconciliation. And I want to make sure that everybody understood that I had seen that. That's it. That's
nice.
It.
Nice. Would you say 15 it's or 54 anywhere, billion, but, you know, the deficit?
It's $54 billion.
Got it. Yes. Which is funny because it's a little bit of a double-edged sword. They were like, yes, it's definitely related to budget and spending.
Yeah.
But in the way that will, you know, make Republicans not want to do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's that.
And there are some Dems who don't want to do it either. Joe Manchin's not going to want to do it. And so it's kind of dead in the water. But
or anyway, not. We'll
so
see.
That's my little dose of, you know, serious economic policy. One really depressing and one kind of just stupidly procedurally interesting. That's it. That's what I got.
Well,
on Monday.
From the desk of, like, sometimes intent makes a big difference, even though it takes a long time for policy to catch up. Someone tweeted at me today to alert me to President Joe Biden's interview with CBS News Sunday, mm-hmm. I guess, in which he said that women dropping out of the workforce was a national emergency and needed to be treated as
that.
Such.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
So
that's great. That's good.
That was good. Like, yay for saying it out loud, if not being able to
That's
immediately
great.
Do something about it. So, yeah. Yeah. A baby smile. A baby smile.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll give
before
it.
Before we move to the... Yeah. All right, cool. Shall we then?
All right, Ben. Hit it.
Or I.
I got not... Some, I'm in not a terrible mood today, but I just didn't find anything that really tickled me. I punted.
I know. No, that totally happens. Yeah, I hear you. Because usually someone just sends me something funny. Someone sent something funny, and it was just the guy dancing on TikTok, and I was like, well, that won't work.
Nobody sends
me anything, man. I don't know, really? Not even family chat? That's where all the good stuff comes from. But I had saved this story from the weekend, slacked it to myself like I do, which is the only way to like get information mm-hmm. across platforms. And it was a USA Today piece from, I guess, Sunday that said Pfizer expects to cut COVID-19 vaccine production time by close to 50% as production ramps up and efficiencies increase. They said that they would be able to cut the amount of time it takes to produce a batch of vaccine from 110 days to an average of 60 days.
That would be huge. That would be good news.
That is huge. Yep. I mean, that's huge. And it basically is because, you know, they'd skipped all the steps that you go through normally to start producing and manufacturing at a mass level, went straight to it. Like, okay, we're learning, and they're learning while they produce. And so as they produce, they're like, oh, we could probably cut out this step. We could like make this more efficient, you know, so and so and so. They made sure to say many times in the course of the article that none of those things are related to the safety of the vaccine. It's more, you know, like when you do something the first time, you're slow. And then when you do it the 100th time, you're faster.
Which That's totally true.
It's really great.
Well, that's good to know because I've been feeling a little bit not hopeful about vaccines lately. I don't know. Whatever. Now you're bringing me down. Shut up. All right. Let's get out of here. No. I'm not going there.
We know actual people who have been vaccinated. Like, it's happening. It's happening.
I know. Look, my mom's in line for her second shot. It is totally happening. And when the first people I knew started getting their shots, I was like, yay, it's happening. And now I guess it's like a little bit of, you know, the morning after. And I'm like, oh, God, whatever.
I know. We're still 342nd million and 346 million, respectively, or whatever.
That's probably a long way from us. Yeah.
But yeah, don't let the variants thing get you down. Like, look, these mRNA vaccines are great. It's going
to work. You know what I heard today? I was listening to, I don't even know who it was, on the way down to the office because I have to go into the office because, my Comrex dies and my home internet is terrible. But anyway, listen to the local talk show here on KPCC, and they had a woman from, I don't even know where it was. And she said the thing about these mRNA vaccines is they can be pretty easily adapted to handle those variants. And even if we get a lot of variants, you can sort of stack the counter variant thing on the vaccine, and that kind of works really well. So I felt pretty good about that.
Yeah.
Look at that.
The mRNA thing is remarkable. Good. See, technology will save us. That's it for today.
Oh, my God.
We're going to end now while he's laughing. We will be back tomorrow with a deep dive on the minimum wage, which is turning out to be so much more of a complex topic than we ever expected, even in terms of the research around it. We will attempt to break it all down. In the meantime, keep sending us your questions and your comments. MakeMeSmart@marketplace.org. We love to hear you.
That's Ben Talley in the music that he wrote.
That's right.
So Make Me Smart is produced and sometimes directed by Marissa Cabrera. Tony Wagner does production stuff for us. Erica Phillips writes our newsletters and the Make Me Smart skill on your smart devices.
Today's program was engineered by Ben Talladay, who just tried to keep his panic down as Kai's Comrex blipped back and forth during this show. He also composed our theme music with Daniel Ramirez. I wonder if he sings along every time. Plays along, like a little air guitar situation. The senior producer is Donna Tam.
I don't know.
We're going to, Ben, you're going to have to sing. Sorry. The executive director of On Demand is Sitara Nieves. Can we, come on, can we have like Make Me Smart song karaoke? That would be amazing.
Strong communication skills are critical for success in business and in life. Hi, I'm Matt Abrahams, and I host Stanford Graduate School of Business's Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. Each week, I sit down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you with your communication skills, from conflict management to mastering small talk to tackling communication anxiety. Join us and start to develop and hone your communication skills. Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.